Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Africa. With me to discuss U.S. policy toward Africa is Landry Signet. Landry is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at the Thunderbird School of Management, and a distinguished fellow at Stanford University. His most recent book is Unlocking Africa's Business Potential, Trends, Opportunities, Risks, and Strategies. Landry, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Jim.
Now, Landry, last month you wrote a piece for foreignpolicy.com titled How to Restore U.S. Credibility in Africa. I want to delve into the arguments you make there in some of your other publications. But first, I'd like you to tackle a broader question for me. What do you see as U.S. interests in Africa? Are they primarily strategic? Are they economic, diplomatic, democracy and human rights? Some mix of the above?
This is a wonderful question. I think that the U.S. has a unique opportunity to advance its interest in Africa, whether we speak about the strategic perspective, trade, investment, security, peace. And in this particular context, the previous administration developed a strategy aiming at capitalizing on prosperity, on stability, among other core factors. So, and with the new administration, the difference of what happened in the past administration is the implementation. So the past administration really failed by not successfully implementing many of the elements in the blueprints which was developed. Where with the new administration, you really have also a window of opportunity beyond the discourse, of course, but a window of opportunity to engage with Africa in areas which are considered as critical for African. For example, the newly launched African Continental Free Trade Area. So by 2030, Africa will have about $6.7 trillion of combined consumer and business spending, as well as a population of about 1.7 billion people. So this really represents a tremendous opportunity for the United States. It's also important to highlight the competition between emerging and traditional powers in Africa. The space which is not occupied by the U.S. will be occupied by other players, whether we speak about China, Russia, as well as Brazil, the U.K., France, among other players. So you can clearly see that we have a clear economic interest in the relation between Africa and the United States, but you also have the geostrategic one in a context of competition between emerging and established power. And you finally have the principal one. So many of the new players in Africa are not democratic countries. So we want to be mindful if the U.S. want to continue to ensure the broader dissemination of democracy around the world, of human rights. So it's important for the U.S. to be a strong player in Africa. And those areas of interest of the United States are also aligned with areas of interest for African countries. Per Afrobarometer surveys, for example, most African citizens prefer democracy and accountable governance to alternative, over 70% of Africans, to alternative modes of development of governance. And when it comes also to the model of development, African citizens prefer the United States model compared to the Chinese one. This is another critical element. And with the African Continental Free Trade Area, which was launched, Africans are also inviting the United States to collaborate and to partner to achieve mutual prosperity.
You put a lot on the table there, Landry, to get us started, and I'd like to unpack it a bit. So let's sort of begin with the question of, when we talk about Africa, who are we talking about? I get nervous talking about a continent that has 54 UN members as one monolithic whole, when you acknowledge the differences that exist across the continent. And obviously, when we talk about other continents, you talk about Europe a lot. But when we talk about Europe, we recognize that it, to some extent, when the United States thinks about Europe or the transatlantic relationship, it thinks first and foremost of countries like Britain, France, Germany, maybe Italy, and then varying from issue to issue, other countries may get named. So when the United States thinks about Africa, are there particular countries in Africa that it's important for the United States to get right?
Definitely, it is extremely important for the United States to engage, I think, at two levels, at least more than two levels, but to focus the energy. You have the bilateral relation, but you also have the multilateral relation at the continental level. Let me start with the continental perspective. African leaders came together and decided to launch the African Continental Free Trade Area.
And that starts this year, correct?
Absolutely. So the African Continental Free Trade Area was signed in 2018. A sufficient number of countries ratified it in 2019, and it was supposed to be officially launched in July of 2020. Due to COVID-19, the launch was postponed to January 2021 and was successfully launched as of the 1st of January 2021. So the African Continental Free Trade Area is really a tool that African leaders have created, deciding to collaborate and to engage at two levels within Africa, so between African countries, but also a tool for engagement between Africa and the rest of the world when it comes to trade relations. So I think this element is important to highlight, because when it comes to trade, African leaders want to engage with the United States from a regional perspective. That doesn't prevent the existence also of some bilateral relation or partnerships. Now, when we speak about the specific countries which are core to the US strategy in Africa, so you have countries such as South Africa, Morocco, Egypt, Nigeria, among the largest countries, but you also have countries such as Sudan, Mali, Angola, Zambia, which are countries where the US has to pay special attention given the new development. Another good partner of the US is definitively Kenya or other countries such as Ghana, among others. So it's really important to put into context those dynamics, both the continental dynamic, but also the regional and sub-regional dynamic. For Egypt, for example, the engagement between Egypt and the United States is clearly explained by the geopolitical interest. If we include, if we take into consideration the Middle East also, and the US strategy toward the Middle East. But now, when you speak about South Africa or Nigeria, they are the two African economic giants. In fact, if you consider South Africa, Nigeria, and Egypt, you already have more than half of the gross domestic product of the wealth of Africa, including in terms of also combined consumer and business spending. So they really offer tremendous opportunity to the United States. But now, if you come to some of the individual countries, speaking about the case of Zambia, for example, is a core country given the debt crisis that Zambia is facing, with the involvement of other players such as China. And the US has the opportunity to engage with broader partners, because the type of configuration that we have in Zambia, which has led to the debt default, is, although the Zambian case is extreme, this type of configuration is also existing in other countries, and if not properly addressed, will have monumental consequences.
Laundrie, if I can, before we get into individual countries, what I'd like to do is actually pursue your point about China. So I want to talk a little bit about sort of the geopolitical context. And my takeaway from what we've discussed so far is that the United States needs to recognize that there are both significant countries on the continent of Africa that have the potential to be strong partners because of the capabilities they have, because of the influence they have in their part of Africa. At the same time, there are also countries that have significant challenges. Those challenges may be sort of on the front page with those countries, but they're challenges that other countries in Africa share. I do want to come back to that, but I just want to have you map out for me China's role on the continent, because a lot of people have talked about China going abroad. I've heard a lot of talk about China's role in Africa. Certainly a number of American scholars saying that China's growing prominence in Africa is actually bad news for the United States. We need to see ourselves as part of a competition. And so, you know, I'm wondering here, you know, to what extent that is the case. I mean, I grant the fact you point out in your foreign policy article that China is now Africa's largest trade partner. It's the biggest bilateral lender to most or many African countries. And surprisingly, China, not the United States or Britain, is the largest destination for English-speaking African students. And China is investing heavily in training African journalists harvest. They're giving a fair amount of vaccine to African countries. So when I hear that, I guess my question is, isn't this good for Africa? And why is it bad for the United States?
Yes, thank you very much for highlighting some of the key arguments of my foreign policy piece, especially the fact that China is now the first commercial trade partner of numerous African countries, the first investor in terms of bilateral infrastructure investment, the first destination of English-speaking African students when compared to the United States or Great Britain, China trained African journalists. Additional factors, we really take into consideration include the fact that we have had an exponential growth of export from China to Africa over the past two decades, the increased import from Africa, the substantial lending to African countries, and we have definitively major lending on transport, power, and mining. So China like to speak about development finance versus development assistance. You have the growing foreign direct investment, even if the US still lead the way with the foreign direct investment, but China has been growing substantially. So you have for China the domination of port investment in Africa, the importance also of the presence of Chinese workers in Africa, the FOCAC, and so the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation, which remain a critical tool. You have the multiplication of Confucius Institutes in Africa in general. So I think that the involvement of China and of new players represent both an opportunity, but also a challenge for many African countries. So I want to bring agency. I want to bring back agencies to African leaders. So for African leaders who are accountable and who are living in countries where you have the rule of law, you have democratic development with strong checks and balances systems. So the competition between numerous players is a positive development because it provides additional tools to accelerate their development and eventually contribute to the sustainable development goals among others. But now when we speak about countries which are not democratic and for which may also be democratic, but for which the leaders may not be accountable, that is where we have many reasons to be concerned, because the presence of players which are not democratic can contribute to weaken the already poor institutions. So that is one of the factors. But you also have the question of corruption, which could also be affecting quite negatively. You have the quality of infrastructure, the lack of transfer of technologies to local partners. So you also have the environmental standards, which may or not be respected. And that's why the United States really has a critical role to play in Africa in addressing some of those challenges. Because per U.S. law, if an American citizen is corrupt in Africa, and if that is established, the given citizen will be penalized according to the regulation. So that is why it is really important to continue to nurture, to develop, to unlock U.S.-Africa relations. So that's for the question of corruption. But you also have the U.S. in the broader engagement will also be committed to discuss questions related to human rights, to also engage in governance standards, to engage in reducing risk for conflict among others, and ultimately the overall quality of infrastructure and of the products and services which are delivered, that overall quality is higher when we compare to some of the emerging players. And if we add to this fact the notion that I mentioned before, African citizens per Afrobarometer survey prefer democracy and accountable governance, that is a clear area of sustainable competitive advantage for the United States. And African citizens also per Afrobarometer surveys also prefer the US development model compared to the Chinese one. This is another element of sustainable competitive advantage that the US can use to make a difference and build mutual prosperity.
So let's talk a bit about the US advantage in Africa compared to the Chinese. I take your point, Landry, that the risk of Chinese investment and interest in Africa is that you're going to get distorted economic growth, you're going to get more corruption, you're going to get the undermining of democratic government. Obviously, the Chinese countries are not in the business of exporting democracy. And I take your point on the advantages that the United States brings to any conversation with Africans, being the fact that Africans and the African people like democracy. They like the U.S. developmental model. They like the idea of the rule of law, that people are held accountable to the law. And I would imagine, and you've written about this, that the U.S. track record in Africa also can be a big help over the last several decades. We've had things like the Millennium Challenge account. We've had PEPFAR, a major initiative to deal with HIV infections in Africa, the president's malarial initiative. We've had a special trade preferences for Africa over the years, AGOA, which I think is up for expiration in a few more years. It was started in 2000. I think it expires in 2025, though I would expect Congress to renew it. But I also, in these conversations, often hear people talk a lot about the disadvantages the United States brings as well. I'd like to get your comment on that, you know, particularly as, you know, Africans, like much of the rest of the world, looked at the United States over the last several years, and they see a country that was once capable of doing great things, now struggling with COVID-19. Many people across the African continent reacted to the killing of George Floyd and sort of the bearing of, you know, clear systemic racism in the United States. The policies, immigration policies, the Trump administration targeted many African countries. To what extent does that sort of play into African attitudes? And I realize I'm sort of taking everybody in Africa and putting in one category, but sort of how does that play into this dialogue? We're talking about the United States coming in and trying to build a better relationship.
It is clear that many African leaders and citizens were shocked by the tone and by many policies which were adopted during the past few years. And what you call a disadvantage, as a matter of fact, was, so whether we speak about the, so I will not perhaps use the same words because those are not part of my vocabulary, but
we appreciate that, Landry.
So those have substantially, let's say, deteriorated the image and the credibility of the United States in Africa, or at least with many of the African partners. However, the new administration, or many steps taken by the new administration, even during the campaign, the Biden candidate at the time submitted a policy engaging with Africa and the diaspora, which was welcome at the time. And once elected, President Biden also gave a statement recently to the African Union. So an early engagement and a positive engagement. I think the difference that I want to bring is that African leaders, but also many of the citizens, make a difference between the action of individual leaders and the overall position of the United States and its administration or various administrations. So although the credibility has been affected during the past 4 years, I think that the enthusiasm that I have seen with the new administration, whether here in DC with the African Diplomatic Corps, or in Africa with various players, is encouraging and demonstrate that the US has a unique opportunity to really restore its credibility in Africa, and not just in Africa. I think those dynamics were not just relevant for Africa. They were also relevant to many of the other American partners, whether in Europe, Latin America, and Asia.
Landry, let me draw you out on that, because we're now a month into the Biden presidency. When I think back to the campaign trail, I don't recall candidate Biden talking much about Africa. Though it's fair to point out, I don't recall him being asked many questions about Africa on the campaign trail. When I look at the team that he has assembled, few members of his national security and foreign policy team have deep experience with Africa. And as best I can tell, he has yet to nominate the people who are going to be charged with handling the Africa portfolio on a day-to-day basis in the various executive agencies. So what do you expect a Biden presidency to do on Africa? Or maybe there are things that they've already done that I've missed.
No, thank you very much for this an important question. Perhaps I just want to bring some elements which were in the Biden-Harris agenda for the African diaspora. So during the campaign, they mentioned the critical importance of immigration. They had aspects related to the economy, including manufacturing and innovation, infrastructure, racial equity, among other. You also have aspects related to education, so including the support to educator and affordable education and training beyond high school. You also have healthcare workers and the imperative of strong US-Africa policy, including affirming or asserting the commitment to critical values such as prosperity, democracy, governance, among other, or restoring diplomatic relations with numerous African government and institutions, among other. So I just wanted to point out some of those elements which were already presented during the campaign. Now that President Biden is in charge, it is extremely important to see how they will be translated into concrete policies and specific gain. And in order to achieve those goals, I think there are many strategies which could be adopted. For example, I think the US investment should be increased substantially and focus on areas that will foster industrial development and great intra-African trade to really create sustainable growth, which will be less dependent on commodity compared to other players. So I think this is extremely important. So the focus on economic questions and on area of sustainable competitive advantage, including area related to emerging technologies, the fourth industrial revolution, information and communication technology, cyber security, among other factors. So the US should also embrace the African continental free trade area in a more decisive way beyond statements. So I think it's really critical, given the fact that, as I mentioned, the combined consumer and business spending in 2030 in Africa may reach $6.7 trillion, and it will really be important. It represents a tremendous opportunity for both US and African cooperation to accelerate economic prosperity, industrialization, providing jobs, including for young people, for women, among others. So the US should also really reinvigorate its efforts toward governance and private sector engagement, education, and training, which are critical long-lived. But currently, we have the US being challenged in those areas mentioned before. China, for example, is outperforming the US in attracting African students from English-speaking Africa. So that's another critical area where the US should really focus effort to really improve governance. So it is also important to, I think, foreign policy, as pointed out by your president, begins at home. So it is really important, as pointed out by Richard Haas, that the US mobilize its own citizens. It's critical to train people, to increase effort to document and disseminate the tremendous potential Africa can have for the US businesses, as well as create a high-level forum for direct engagement. So this will really be extremely important, including for SMEs, both in Africa and in the United States. So the US should also promote commercial diplomacy through an economic strategy that goes beyond the traditional vision of trade and investment. So it is really important to accelerate facilitation activities, encouraging business development, among other. And I think when it comes to Africa, the US has demonstrated a relative bipartisan consensus when it comes to African policies, and this should be continued and even accelerated to really build mutually beneficial relations. So I think that in the COVID-19 context, the Biden administration will have many challenges at home, but there is no better time than now to engage with African countries, with Africa in general, whether at the continental level with institutions such as the African Union or the African Continental Free Trade Area, but also at the local level, because for many reasons, but one of those reasons, the fact that the US has a sustainable competitive advantage when it comes to areas which are considered as critical for Africans, or whether we speak about accountable governance, democracy, among other. And the US is also considered as a model by African citizens when it comes to free trade. The US has been a unique player and should continue to do so by engaging at the continental level with the African continental free trade area. So I think those are some of the core points where the Biden administration can do a deep dive to really accelerate, unlock U.S.-Africa relations potential and challenge some of the emerging or even more traditional powers in Africa.
I take your point, Landry, about the importance of encouraging regional trading agreements. I think the social science literature is very clear that those parts of the world where trade among countries has been encouraged has done better than those parts of the countries where the interconnections among countries are much more fragile or non-existent. And again, it's a really big issue because it's not simply a matter of lowering a trade barrier. It also is there a road to get from one country to another? You know, how crowded is the bridge and what have you. And I take your point also about the importance of having a policy that focuses on things like providing technical support to make initiatives work. But I want to pick up on one point you made toward the end, and that is about vaccines for COVID-19. As you know, Andrea, there's been a lot of talk about vaccine nationalism, countries that are producing the vaccine essentially saying, we're going to make sure our people get vaccinated. Now, the Chinese and the Russians, to some extent, have talked about giving vaccines to other countries. The Russian vaccine, my understanding is actually, according to independent assessments, done very well. I've heard mixed news about the Chinese vaccine and how effective it is. But when you think about that, and you think about the ability of the United States to sort of gain, secure, and build on an advantage in Africa, how important will it be for the Biden administration to be seen taking steps to make sure that African countries get access to the vaccine? And I say that in the recognition that as of right now, if you look at the 130 poorest countries in the world, they essentially have zero vaccine.
This is an extremely important point. I think that the Biden administration has the unique opportunity to announce a global initiative for vaccine accessibility around the world in countries which are left behind, or in particular for Africa. The cost of such an initiative will not be as high compared to the potential benefit of restoring U.S. leadership and credibility worldwide and targeting perhaps some of the region or the countries which are in the developing world and in Africa in particular, the most affected. So the French president has engaged recently encouraging numerous nations to give a small percentage of their vaccine stock, thinking that this will not affect the overall impact of their campaigns. So I definitely think that President Biden and Vice President Harris can really lead the way globally by announcing such an initiative and collaborating with other countries in order to ensure that countries which are left behind, especially in Africa, but around the world, may also have access to the COVID-19 vaccine.
I should just also note in that point that President Biden has pledged to devote some $4 billion to this task, as I understand it. And he has also had the United States join COVAX, which is the international alliance, seeking to make sure that vaccines get to people all around the world, because it is not only an opportunity to build soft power, it's actually a matter of one's own health security, because to the extent we don't vaccinate people, the virus can circulate, it can mutate. And as we have seen, variations or mutations of the virus could produce versions or strains that are not well controlled by existing vaccines, and we can relive this whole experience. I don't think anybody wishes to do so. I'm just curious if we could just close, Landry, quickly. As you look at the Biden team as it's sort of coming into place, how optimistic are you that they're going to be able to act quickly on many of these issues, just given, well, number one, the president has his hands full with lots of issues, and as you pointed out, he has many issues at home to take care of, but also just sort of the inevitable challenges of trying to staff up in administration. Because again, you look around the world, I think in almost every country I can think of, people are sort of waiting and saying, when is this administration going to address the issues that I care about?
This is an important question, but before, I just want to mention probably one thing that Africans will really appreciate will be the level of commitment for Africa when it comes to the global vaccine campaign. So it's really important to be more specific about the broader commitment to Africa, but also eventually to specific African countries, unless that responsibility is given perhaps to the African Union. So that's why such a global or African initiative, what the leadership could really, so joining the existing effort, but probably also starting or engaging with new initiatives, which will be specific in terms of goals to be achieved and implemented. So now, this is a complex question because in agenda setting, so the presidential agenda is already quite full only at home. However, I also think that there's a trade-off which is really important when in order to advance U.S.-Africa relations. A good point is the fact that President Biden has demonstrated that he is thinking about Africa, or that the Biden administration is thinking about Africa. Speaking or engaging during the African Union summit is a sign that this conversation is ongoing.
So showing up and paying respect matters.
Absolutely. Having a conversation with President Ramaphosa is extremely important. So if you recall, President Trump has never visited sub-Saharan Africa. So I think President Biden will most likely visit Africa, sub-Saharan Africa in particular. So we have a change of tone, which is extremely important and which make a significant difference compared to what happened in the past. So the change of tone is important. Showing up is also important. Engaging with African in the platforms which are the most valued by African. This is, symbolically speaking, is also extremely important.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Landry Sinyeg. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at the Thunderbird School of Management, and a distinguished fellow at Stanford University. You can read his piece, How to Restore U.S. Credibility in Africa, at foreignpolicy.com. Landry, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.